Welcome to the Young Israel version of the Hilchos Nida Men's Review Shir. And stop me if at any time. It is going to be a very, very, have to say, brief overview of the general halachas of Hilchos Nida. So if you have any questions, it's just a good review, in case you're looking for a review of the broad strokes of the halachas. And if there are specifics, you can ask questions. Feel free to ask questions. And I don't guarantee I'll know the answers off the top of my head, but I'll be happy to look into them if you have any questions. So the first issue that comes up in Hilchos Nida is the general hashkafa of the laws of Nida. The hashkafa of the laws of Nida, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create these laws that ostensibly create this separation, this division between husband and wife? And the main and most important answer is, it doesn't matter. Right? This is a din in the Torah. And sometimes we try to divine the tam eha mitzvos behind them, but especially these mitzvos in the Torah are laws of tumah and tara, many of which we don't really comprehend necessarily. And even if we do think that we understand them, there's a danger in saying, "Well, I know the reason, and since the reason is X, Y, or Z, therefore I can, I have already addressed that issue. That issue is not relevant to me." Etc., etc. And we're familiar in our society all too often with this phenomenon of, well, since I know the reason, therefore I can circumvent the reason. So reason A, 1A is, this is a mitzvah deraisa in the Torah of the separation between husband and wife, and it's important for us to realize that, and that's the most important emphasis. But now that we said that, that being said, there are incredibly important tangible benefits to the laws of Taras HaMishpacha. I like to think of Taras HaMishpacha as being an opportunity for a husband and wife to be husband and wife in a different manner than the physical relationship. Very often people, when they're in a good physical relationship, they define their relationship by that physicality. And what Nida does is it forces the husband and wife to relate to each other in a non-physical way, which is extremely important. And it gives a whole new dimension to what marriage is really supposed to be about. Because otherwise, the physicality becomes the entirety of the relationship, or it has the potential to become the entirety of the relationship, and that's not really what a good relationship, what a good marriage is all about. In addition, I think something that men are not always sensitive to is the notion that women need a sense of privacy. Even in the context of marriage, where there's ostensibly no secrets, and husband and wife sharing the most intimate of relationships, nonetheless, both the husband and wife, to my mind, need to have a sense of privacy. So we go into our whatever man room, you know what I'm saying, and watch a football game, or we go to the chavrusa, or wherever we go, we take a walk, or we have our alone time. But very often, women also need to have a sense of privacy and individuality. And when husband and wife are forced to be separate from the physical in a physical way, that gives them that sense of space that women, I think, very often need. So all that being said, very good. There's some very nice reasons. But even if a person can't say, well, my wife and I get on so well that we don't have to get the harchakas, or that's all very nice to tami hamitzvos. But the bottom line is, in Hilchos Nida, this is a din in the Torah, and it's our obligation to uphold it to the in a most meticulous and appropriate fashion, and it's important for us to remember that as well. Okay, so that's the hashkafa. Any questions on my little hashkafic overview? No? Very good. Okay, and we'll get into some of the hashkafa of some of the harchakos as well. What is Anida? What is Anida? So the Torah, interestingly enough, there are two Isurei Torah that the Torah talks about. So it's important to understand what the Isurei Torah really are and what the confusion really is all about. The Torah talks about two possible sources of flow of blood that a woman might have. The first one is in Vayikra Perek Tesvav. The Torah says, Isha, ki tiye zava dama, zava dam yebsara, shivas yamin tiye benidata, if a woman has a normal flow, what we would call a menstrual flow, she is a nida, right? And how long is a woman nida raisa a nida for?
Until she finishes.
No. From the beginning of her flow, how long is she a nida for? 7 days. 7 days. The trick, and that's what Torah says, Tiabi Nidasa. She's a Nida for 7 days. Right? Total of 7 days, and that's all. From the beginning of the onset of Nidus until the end, 7 days, and that's all you need. But there's another category of Nida, of what we would call of impurity, that's called Dam Ziva. Right? The only problem, the trick is, well, we'll see what is Dam Ziva. So the Torah says if a woman is a Zava, so a male can be a Zava also. But a male, it's very easy to know because he only has certain types of emissions, of seminal emissions. And so if a man has some kind of seminal emission that we don't really know what it is anymore, he's a Zav. But a woman, the identity of the Ziva and the Dam Nida are tricky, as we'll see. But the halacha of the Zava is, it says, once she's Tahara, she can be a Zav Yom Echad. So if she's Zav Yom Echad, then she's Tameh only 1 day. If she's Zav 2 days, then she's Dam two days. Yom Kineged Yom. But on the third day, if she's Zava Gedola, it's called, then the Torah says, then she has to wait until she stops seeing Dam Ziva, and she's Tara Mizova, Bisafra La Shivas Yamim V'achar Titar. After the Ziva ends, after that flow ends, then she becomes she is still Tumea, she has to have 7 clean days, which we call Shiva Nikiyim, right? And after those 7 clean days, then she can go to the mikvah and she becomes a tahora. So we have Nida, which is from the onset of the Nida. I mean, if a woman became a Nida, Nida Raisa. If a woman became a Nida tonight, right? Tonight is Wednesday night. She would count 7 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbat, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And Nida Raisa, this is not the way we hold now. Nida Raisa, she would go to the mikvah on the Tuesday evening, on Wednesday, and she's tahora. If she's a Zava, right? If she's a Zava Gedola, she leaves for 3 days, let's say. And then on the fourth day, she has to begin counting 7 days. And then on the night of the 11th, then she can go to the mikvah, and she's a Tahora. Those are the dinim Nida Raisa. By the way, what's the punishment for someone who lives with a Nida, who's Bola Nida? Correct. It's a pretty big one, right, which is one of the reasons why we're so absolutely meticulous about the halachos of Nida, because it's a very, very stringent prohibition in the Torah. Okay, so we have Ziva, we have Dam Ziva, and we have Dam Nida, Zava and Anida. The trick is, what is the definition of Ziva? Right, so it's a huge machlokes in the Rambam, and I think the Rashba, what the difference is. And it's not clear, like, we don't really have, there's no consensus about what the definition of a Ziva is. The Rambam says it all goes on a schedule. When a woman gets a period the first time, then she counts a certain amount of weeks after that, and if she gets a period during those weeks, that's Dam Ziva. And other opinions differ about the definition of Dam Ziva, but the bottom line is, today, we have no idea what the difference is between Dam Ziva and Dam Nida. So the question comes, like everybody knows, what's the minimum amount of time nowadays after a woman sees it becomes a Nida that you have to wait? 12 days. Minimum 12 days. It's usually somewhere between 12 and 14 days. So how do we get from 7 in the Torah, which is, the Torah says quite clearly on the 7th day after a Nida, how do we get from 7 to 14? So the Gemara says it quite obviously. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Zeira is a very... well-known Gemara, what? Yeah. The Nos Yisrael Hichmiru al-Atzma. Not the men, the women, right? Because this was, the Gemara says, Amar Vilsi, Amar Yudal Merab, Hitkin Rebbe Besado. Sado is the name of a place. Ratha Yomecha, Teisha Shisha Yomech. So Rebbe was Machmir, and no matter what, she has to treat it like Dam Nida. Even if she only sees 1 day. If she sees the blood for one day. So, but then Rav Zeira said, Nos Yisrael Hichmiru al-Atzma, the Nos Yisrael were more meticulous. Shafilu rov tipat dam kechardal. Even if she only sees a drop of blood, kechardal. You ever heard that term? Tipat dam kechardal, right? Like the size of a mustard seed. If she sees a speck of blood, size of a mustard seed, yosu has to have shiva nikiyim. She has to sit around and see shiva nikiyim. Rashi says on there, what is it? What is a visados? Says makom she'ein b'nei Torah. People were not Torah knowledgeable. The Einam Yodos Limnos Petach Nidos Matayim Yimei Nida Matayim Neziva. Like us, they have no idea when is Yimei Nida, when is Yimei Ziva, when is the right count. Now, just understand also, it's quite clear from the Gemaras and from the sources that women's cycles were far more regulated in the time of the Gemara than they are today. So, for example, the Gemara talks about something that we call a Veset Kavua. In the times of the Gemara, a veset kavua, a veset means an expected period. It was normal for a woman to have a veset kavua. I mean, just it was just a usual thing that a woman had a veset kavua, and she would know exactly when she was going to get a period. Nowadays, it's unheard of for a woman to establish a veset kavua.
Naturally.
Right, without help. Correct, without help. I mean, we can force the issue, but without help. So one gets a sense that women are much less in tune with their bodies today, and with all the topsy-turvy nature of the lives in which we live, you know, we're not really much better off, and that there's something that, like a lack of connection to ourselves in a physical way. So they we don't know, damida or damziva. So the Torah says the following, Mishrabu Agalios, this is Torah, Yeridea Simim Kuf Pei Gimel, when there were, you know, the many exiles, the Tukfu Atzaros, and there were great troubles, with itmatu halavavos, and the hearts became smaller. Chashu shema yavo litos v'isur kares. Of course, since nida is an isur kares, we're very nervous about it. Shema tira isha bimei nidasa shisha yamin. V'yea kol dam tahor. Because we're afraid. What happens? So we said, remember, if she's a nida, she only has to count 7 days from the beginning of nida, and then she's fine. Then she goes to the mikvah. So now she's afraid. What happens if the first 6 days she sees dam, blood, but it's not nidus? What happens, and it's really, she has a, I don't know, she has a urinary tract infection, right? Or she has a, you know, an ovarian cyst, God forbid, or whatever it is. She sees blood, and normally blood from a maka, we say, blood from an injury, is dam tohar. It's not impure blood. So therefore, she counts 6 days, and then the seventh day she sees blood, but she has a seventh day, right? And then she figures, my nidus is over, but the seventh day she saw dam, and she saw blood, and that wasn't dam nida, it was dam ziva. So how many days does she have to count now? Another 7 days. Maybe she's going to make a mistake. So she's going to think of it as Sabura, Litva, Balel, Shemini. She thinks that she can go to the mikvah on the night of the 8th, Vitzricha, Shiva, Yamim, and she needs another whole 7 days. So therefore, Hichmiru, no, this is the women, right? We can't even, normally, sometimes you can blame the Rabbanan. But it's like very clear, like in the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch and the Torah, the nose, you see this term over and over again, the nose, he smiled, the chmir al-asman. The women can't blame the rabbis in this case. Right? The Jewish daughters, they were machmir on themselves. Letame kol mara dam edom. Adom, to impurify, to be metame any stain, any red stain. And so that they would not confuse between dam nida and dam ziva. Hosifru chumra achar chumra. It's unbelievable. One stringency after another. Ad sha'amru afilu im latira isha ela tipa dam kechada. Even if she only sees, right, this mustard size stain, the smallest stain in the world, teisha will have shivin akim kezava gadola. So she has to make it as if she was a zava gadola. So you can see, by the way, just how machmer we are. Normally, if a woman sees, if she sees blood, it has to be a flow. We're going to define what's the definition of nidus. Okay, but it has to be a flow. It has to be a serious flow in order to be serious menstruation. But here, all she sees is a speck of blood, and if it's a speck of blood in the, what we'll say is the wrong place at the wrong time, right, and she notices it and she sees it, then she's considered a nida, and she has to wait as if she was a zava gadola, if she was a real zava. She has to be especially careful about that. Okay.
The case that you said where she sees zava blood for 6 days, and then the last day...
So she sees Dmei Tohar. She sees Dmei Tohar.
So the thing is, she would still have to wait until the flow...
The flow stopped that night. According to the halacha nida araisa, a nida is only 7 days. Doesn't matter how long.
Dam nida, could it be dam nida that it stops
for one day? And you see all kinds of crazy things. Sure. I mean, it's very unusual, but you see all kinds of crazy things. What is it? Oh, so this is a good question. What is the definition of dam nida? So dam nida is what happens is the following. In a woman's reproductive system, right? Her ovaries produce eggs. Right? And as her system, as her uterus prepares itself for the implantation of the fertilized egg for reproduction, the lining of the uterine lining builds itself up. It builds itself up in order to become a fertile area for the fertilized egg to mature and develop into a child. Now, if the egg is fertilized and the and placed in the uterus, the hormones know, the body knows, one of the miracles of creation, that the body knows and the uterus continues to build up, continue to build up, and the child, God willing, is conceived, it develops. But if the egg fertilized, there is no fertilized egg, or the egg does not attach itself, then the uterine lining withdraws, it decays, it falls away, and that becomes menstrual, the woman's menstrual period, that becomes menstrual bleeding, and that bleeding is what we call damnida. That's the bleeding that we call damnida. Okay, so how does a woman become nida raisa? So there's a few ways for a woman to become nida raisa. One is she has what's called argasha, and the Gemara says, and the dam, blood flows mimikora, from her makor, not from a wound. Okay, so she has to have nida raisa, she has to have a hargasha, but we don't worry about that. Even Darabana, we paskin, we're much more machmir. Okay, so one thing we're often afraid of is what happens if her hargasha is messed. We're afraid that if a woman sees blood, right, when she would never be able to feel her menstruation, her period. Okay, so one example, there are two classic examples that are given. One is when a woman is urinating. Okay, so if a woman sees urine, the Shulchan Aruch, there's a whole similar Shulchan Aruch about that. Isha Sharasha, that Ra'at Adam, the Hashtana, a woman sees blood in her urine. Right, if she sees blood in her urine, it's a problem. Why? Because we're afraid that while she was urinating, she had a hargasha, but she didn't feel it. So that's a concern. So what do we normally tell women to do when they're urinating? What do we tell them to do? Don't look. It's a very classic thing, a very important rule for women to realize. Don't look. Right? You're not supposed to look. All right, aren't you hiding your eyes from the truth? The answer is, well, I'll explain to you later, no, you're not. Right? Because these halakhic principles are so machmir, there's so many chumras, that we are assuming the principle of chazaka unless you lose it. So you don't want to lose a chazaka. You know, sometimes information you're not aware of, you don't know about, is better. Second problem is when perhaps if a woman is during marital relations. Right, during related marital relations, a woman would also not feel a hargasha. So it's very important for women not to do bidikas, I would say, after relations, because if she sees any blood, that would be a serious concern. I mean, the both can talk about very serious problems if a woman bleeds after marital relations. So nowadays, we would generally assume, if a woman really had a blood flow after relations, what would we assume?
It was due to the
relations. Right, the relations are causing, there's an irritation involved. And first thing we would do is tell her to go to the doctor. And second thing we would do is tell her to use a lubricant. And that would alleviate the problem. And the third thing we'd tell her to do is not to check, which is also very, very important. That, you know, unless it's something that's unavoidable, there's serious blood flow. But normally in those cases where a woman is really bleeding after intercourse, the intercourse is incredibly uncomfortable. She has a certain dryness, and that's due to a more serious medical condition that has to be looked at. And so that's an important thing for people to be aware of. What? Oh, I'm not talking about. I'm ignoring dam besulim. Dam besulim is when a woman is a besula, a virgin, and that of course is another type of blood that halachically, if you look in the Gemara, halachically it's dmei tohar. It's clearly not tameh. But again, we're machmir for everything. So even the newlyweds on the first night, if a woman sees blood at all, the dam besulim, she becomes treated like a normal nida. Okay, one of the big questions that come up, I said I was going to talk about the top 10 questions, the main question, the biggest, not going to get to 10, but...
Even if the basula doesn't see blood, I thought she's a nida.
We assume that she saw, if she's a normal basula and it became hidden or whatever, yeah.
The concept of hargasha, I thought that too, we don't...
Correct, we don't know what the hargasha is, but we're afraid that the woman had a hargasha and didn't know it. Right, that's our concern. Women clearly do have a certain feeling when they're getting their period.
Right.
We don't know what it is. Right. We don't know if that's the hargasha or not. Okay, the most common question, and I think the most common question that's not asked is, right, women very often will stain. And they'll see stains, and they will not ask, I think more often than not, I would say, especially in the more modern Orthodox community, in the Yeshivish community, women are trained to ask. And it's a shailan, and it's just a normal thing. But in the more modern Orthodox community, I find it very interesting that there's a level of discomfort of asking these kinds of she'elot. Because, of course, it's very intimate. I think also it's very interesting, maybe this is my own personal social commentary, in this community, the Young Israel community, so I have a more casual relationship with the women in the community. We do programming together, and I give a lot of shiurim, and it's more of a personal relationship. And I think that because of that personal relationship is there, so there's a certain reluctance to the rabbi that I've got to look at, yes, I'm going to show him my underwear. You understand what I'm saying? Whereas, you know, in a more classic community, or the more right-wing community, the rabbi is the posek. You know, he's an authority. I don't, he doesn't know me. I don't really know him. I don't have a relationship with him. We don't go to lunch together. You know what I'm saying? So to ask him these kinds of questions, and there's a greater level of comfort. And I don't really know the answer to that, because in our community, it's important for women in the community to have a relationship with the rabbi. But that relationship is a barrier. Yeah.
So it's probably working on an arrangement with another rabbi that knows how to do
reading. Yeah, I think that happens, right? Correct. Keep it outside the community. Or one thing we never did, which Afreno and I did in another shul, is
the wife.
Well, either through the wife, or even through the wife, there's a level of discomfort. You could develop a sort of system of anonymity where it's only a phone number and you drop it off. Even though it's a little tricky, because there's still very often when there are questions, you need information. When is this from? What's it from? Et cetera, et cetera. So the top question that people, I think, unfortunately don't ask is this stain appropriate? Is it a stain or is it not a stain? And in general, when a woman is tahara and pure, okay, it's very hard for her to become impure. And that's in general. It really is. Why? Because the only way a woman can become tamea is if she sees either a flow, and when we say a flow, you're talking about a significant amount of blood, almost the size of like a dollar bill in a sense, a significant amount of blood on any garment. Because once it's a significant amount of flow, then we have to assume that it's dine nida, that it's the blood of a nida. Or the other possibility is if she sees a stain, a kesem, what we call it, and the kesem has to be of a certain size on a certain type of garment, that is mekabel tuma. So, for example, it has to be a white, right? It has to be on something that's mekabel tuma. It can't be mechuba lekarka, connected to the ground. So it's almost, I mean, it's really quite difficult, unless a woman actually gets a period. If a woman is staining, it's quite difficult for a woman to actually become a nida simply from staining. And staining happens for any number of reasons. You know, there's a certain hormonal imbalance, or very often women who are, for whatever reason, let's assume it's a permitted reason, on a birth control pills, right? If there's a fluctuation in the birth control pills, then women will stain. If they're just getting used to it, women will stain. So any kind of staining the first question you have to ask yourself, if a woman sees a stain, I get a sense very often the women just, I got to go to the mikvah. Whereas in reality, the first question the rabbi's going to ask you is, was it on a color garment or not? And if it was on a, what?
Or was it on paper?
Or was it on paper or not, right? It was a makabel tuma. Was it on a sanitary napkin? All these things, the d'eved, are considered not makabel tuma. So in all these situations, a woman sees stains, right? And she assumes that it's no good. When in reality, the first question you have to ask yourself is, was it a stain at all? And then even if it is on the improper garment, if it is on, you know, for whatever reason, right, what's the color? And that has to be looked at by someone who has the proper training. In general, the rule is only red and black are dam, are blood. And very often, almost always, it's not clear red or clear black. In fact, the shalas that have been asked of me, I would say the vast majority of them are good, meaning not tame, not considered nida. And that only goes to, it just indicates to me, I get a strong sense, I hope this is true, that either, that people are not asking questions and ignoring it, but I'm sure that a lot of people are just kind of assuming that it's no good and erring on the side of caution, which is a shame in a sense, because you don't have to. So that's question 1A. Learn if there's anything you get out of this, it's you have to ask. And as uncomfortable as it is, and that's why I think it's good for men to become involved. So a woman says, oh, I got my period. You know what I'm saying? If it was not the proper time, so what was it really? Was it a stain? Let me ask. And very often, I think the wives will be reluctant if they're not in that frame of mind. And it's important for the husband to be encouraging and say, no, this is important. And if you'd like, I'll go to a different rabbi, you know, somebody who doesn't know you, and we'll ask. And that's a very important role, I think, for men to take, because it shouldn't just be the burden of the woman, because especially it might be uncomfortable for to ask that question. There are unique women who are just like, you know, it's just like, you know, it's like to ask about their pot. It's a question of nida. But many, many women, especially nowadays, more I would say, communally involved women, or or active women, or who know the rabbi, are reluctant, very reluctant to do that. And so that's an important role that the husband can play, or at least he can encourage him. If he doesn't want to call the rabbi, doesn't want to call the rabbi, many women, say many, a good number of women, call my wife. And there's much greater comfort in calling my wife, calling the rabbi, and calling the woman in the community, who can then relay the question anonymously, and very often I won't know who it is. Okay, so I don't know who it is. It's not important. Okay. Any questions? No? Covering it that well. Good. Okay. Next topic we come to. When a woman becomes Nida. So let's say a woman, she gets her normal flow, normal period. Okay, so once a woman gets her period, she becomes a Nida. She is Tamea. And obviously, this is the most relevant area to men. The halacha demands that men and women, the husband and wife, separate in a way that will distance them and prevent them from having any kind of intimate contact. Okay, we call these rachakos. Rachakos from rachok. Okay, so the husband and wife have to separate from each other. So first thing is, no, you're not obviously, this isn't obvious, but first thing is, they are allowed to be miyachay together. Yichud is permitted. Why is yichud permitted, even though every other relationship is not permitted? Right, the Gemara says it's temporary. That a man can control himself in such a way because he knows that later on it's going to be muteri. She's going to be muteris. Whereas any other relationship, yichud is prohibited because it's never going to be permitted. So there's no, why delay something that's never going to be permitted? Okay.
Just curious, how come based on that, how come a chosen and kala can't be miyachid?
Because they never had the opportunity before.
But the same.
The type is too great. The desire is too great. Too great, it's too much to ask.
But we're still saying that it's going to be mutter.
Once you've tasted it, you can wait till the next time.
Okay.
But if you haven't, the desire is too great. Okay. So obviously no physical contact between husband and wife, that's rule 1A. And in addition, husband and wife are not allowed to sleep in the same bed or a connected bed. And the beds have to be separated. The beds have to be separated from one another. Ad kidei kach, that the bed spreads. People wonder how far apart they have to be. So to the point where the blankets themselves do not touch each other when they lie naturally. That's what most poskim hold. That's separate enough. And that's a way of distinguishing between the beds, and that the husband and wife are sitting on separate beds. Another thing that's a little more tricky in the nature of harchakos is what we would call tzchok and kalus rosh. This is a little bit tricky because on the one hand, it doesn't mean to minimize. Tzchok and kalus rosh means lightheadedness, frivolity. What? That's the trick. When a woman becomes a nida, when she experiences this physical separation from her husband, so on the one hand, yes, I spoke about the privacy and how a woman deserves her own privacy and her sense of self. But on the other hand, though, she all of a sudden, she feels a sense of distance and separation from her husband. And there's a sense of pain about that, that women emotionally feel in a good relationship connected to their husbands. And when they're disconnected from their husbands, so then they feel that a level of, there's a barrier in between them. And so unfortunately what can happen is, if there isn't an ongoing emotional relationship, a good relationship, an intellectual or a speaking relationship between husband and wife, then that can be even more painful for the woman during the time of nida. So you don't want to have, on the one hand, so there's a danger of saying, well, we can't be frivolous and we can't be lightheaded, and so you sort of shut off from your wife, and that's probably the worst thing you can do because she needs a little bit more attention and a little bit more, how shall we say, conversation and engagement during that time. But at the same time, what you mean by banter there can be a certain sensuality that a husband and wife exchange, even in everyday conversation. A jokingness, a lightheadedness, that's a kalit rosh, the kalit rosh that the Gemara talks about, that Balacha talks about. And obviously, how do you distinguish between good conversation and banter?
yourself.
Yeah, you know what you see it. I would say a fine line, but everybody knows what the line is. And the fine line does not mean that you shouldn't tell your wife that you love her. I love you is a very important thing to say. It's very important to feel that emotional connection, but the emotional connection isn't necessarily a sexual connection, it's an emotional connection. And again, I think we all understand the difference between those two things and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And it's important for us men to find ways to express that emotion and to express that connectedness during the time of nida, even more so than not. Expressing appreciation, saying I love you, you know, finding ways of going, you know, going out or what have you, you know, making an effort to make
sure.
What?
Understanding,
you know, but it's, you know, it's more than that. It's more, you know, showing attention, because when the physical nature is there, then the woman gets all it, you know, then the attention is obviously there. When it's not physical, the woman needs even more attention than that. Okay. There are one thing a husband can't do when his wife is benida is what we would call gazing, right? Because she is forbidden to him. Now that does not mean that the thing that normally women walk around their tsanua, their hair is covered, and you know, down to their knee, you know, their skirts and whatever. Does that mean that your wife can't wear pajamas in front of you? You know, does she have to cover her hair in front of you? The answer we say is no. She can dress normally, the way she would normally dress in her home, even if it's not outside, in front of you the way she normally would. She can wear pajamas, obviously not provocative, as it were. So she can dress normally, even though it's not, even though we would consider those things dvar erva. But, so if she normally would walk around like in sweatpants and a t-shirt, that's okay. But you obviously can't look at her when she's changing, and there should be a level of privacy and distinction when she's anita. That's another important harkaka. Okay, so we said, and in addition, another halakha we talked about is husband and wife can't touch. And included in that is the fact that husband and wife can't pass things to one another when she's anita. And, I mean, these are common things, but it's important for us to remember them. We're just reviewing them. Okay, in addition, you can't carry things together. So for example, you know, lift things up or you know, I don't know, whatever, you're moving things around in the house. So husband and wife can't carry things together.
And pass the child to one another.
Normally, if the child, we say, is not able to walk on their own or move from one to the other on their own, then the child is considered an inanimate object in a sense, and the child can't be passed. Once a child can go on their own, if the child leans over to the mother, then the mother can, you know, from the father, then they can sort of pass the child from one to the other. But again, these are to create a sense of distance, because Chazal were afraid passing one thing from someone to the other would cause a sense of touching and sense of connectedness would be inappropriate. Not only can't you pass something from one to the other, you can't even throw something from one person to the other. And that's also another hachaka that Chazal instituted.
So basically, if the man is making kiddush.
Well, we're not to that yet. We're right about to get to the dining room etiquette, as it's called. You know, so another area of hachakos was considered areas in the areas of food. So one classic example of halakha regarding food is that a wife may not serve her husband directly during the time of nida. This is, I think, something that people very often don't remember or get flipped up, because you know, you just come home, normally it's dinner time, right? Your wife made dinner, so she serves dinner like she serves all the other times. So a wife is not allowed to serve her husband directly. So you have a number of different options. Option A, you have a serving plate and everybody takes from the serving plate while she's in you, and that's obviously optimal. Option B would be to you know, dole out the food, as it were, and then place it on the table, and then the husband would have to move the plate. Again, that's enough of a heker, enough of a recognizable situation in order to fulfill the hachaka. Another thing that a husband and wife can't do when she's anita is they're not allowed to eat alone together at a table without any heker, any recognizability that she is anita. So, and this is only, by the way, when the husband and wife are eating alone. So let's say, you know, the kids are all asleep, this sometimes will happen, and, you know, you're finally eating dinner together at 9, 10, whenever it is. So if the children are there and they're old enough to ask, you know, why is the Havdalah candle on the table, so then you don't need a heker because then somebody else is at the table. But then you're alone, so you need a heker, so you should place some kind of implement, some kind of item that's going to make it recognizable that that she's a nida, and therefore the meal doesn't become an intimate meal. Another thing a husband can't do is share from the same plate as his wife when she's a nida. Okay, if they're eating directly. Now, if it's a serving plate, so you take your fork, you put it on your thing. But you can't share directly. Like, a good example would be?
Bag of chips.
Yeah, right, a bag of chips. You can't, obviously, share a bag of chips or the popcorn at the movies, you know, or what have you, because that, again, is a problem of nida. Another thing a husband can't do is he can't eat from his wife's plate. The only time he can eat from his wife's plate is after she is finished and left the room. She can eat his, but she can't eat from hers. So there's another example of when we're more machmir on the husband than the wife. Do I need to explain why? No. Right. I think that's relatively self-explanatory.
In a general sense, mm-hmm. It seems that on the bigger issues, the deoraisas and so on, we find kulas and we use kulas and so on. On this drabbanon of hachatas...
What do you mean kulas? What kulas? Give me an example of the deoraisas. I mean, these whole hachatas are chumras upon chumras on to prevent
the deoraisas. No, the fact is the hachatas aren't the isser themselves. They are blocking you from the isser. But when it comes to situations where something might or might not be nida, we...
Meaning when she's already tahora, you're saying, we act in a sort of... I wouldn't say we act in a lenient manner. What I would say is we don't invoke the chumra automatically.
Right.
Meaning when a woman stains, a stain is a stain. It doesn't necessarily mean that a woman, that's menstrual flow. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's in the chumra mentality in which we find ourselves in nida, the fact that you can have a stain, you know, this size and it's not tameh is surprising. But in reality, it's not that surprising.
But we trust in those situations that not only won't people do their own thing, they're going to go extra not to. In other words, they're going to put these chumras on top of themselves.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden we come to their hachakas, and we take it to a big extreme to create these blocks. It seems like they're almost opposing, because we go... passing a plate. There's no sexuality in passing.
Well, hold on. Okay, and this brings me to my mini lecture on the hashkafa of harchakos. Right? Clearly, well, let's finish it, and then I'll get to my hashkafa of harchakos. Another thing that she's not allowed to do is pour drinks for her husband, and vice versa. He can't pour drinks for her, and especially with regard to wine. So that's why you bring up kiddush. Kiddush is the most tricky thing, especially if other people are there. Ideally, when a woman is a nida, and even I would say when a woman is not a nida, because there's an issue of tzinius, because nobody needs to know whether your wife is a nida or not. Well, the ideal thing to do is for the husband to take some, you know, you make kiddush, pour into a cup for himself, drink from the kiddush, and then put the cup down. Right? He's not giving to anyone, not passing to anyone, not giving to anyone, put the cup down. Or, alternatively, as long as he's not passing directly to her, is not pouring directly for her, that's permitted as well. So another alternative is, he drinks, whatever, and then he's got a whole laundry, you know, a whole little thing of cups, he's got the Fisher thing, you know what I'm saying? He pours in, everybody, a bunch of cups are filled, and then the wife takes whichever one she takes. So in that case, he did not pour directly for her. Right?
Passing for the wife, anyway, he said that her passion is passing, but it's more harsh with the wife giving to the husband, and the husband giving.
But the husband is definitely not allowed to pour wine for his wife when she's in need.
Not allowed to pour wine
at all.
But the placing it down for her.
Well, no. You're not allowed to pour or send it to her. You're not allowed to either pour it for her or give it to her. I mean, Chazal clearly didn't envision kiddush. What they envisioned was, you know, a drink of wine between a husband and a wife, a toast or whatever. That's an incredibly sensual event. But we're not going to make we apply it to every case. In the case of pouring wine for your wife, and kiddush is obviously included in them. So those are the two options I would say in general. Let's say, wife, does she sit next to you? I don't know, if she sits next to you, it's easy. You put it down, and then she pours, or she takes, and she gives to everybody else. Or the other alternative, you're pouring for everybody, and she takes one of the cups and the plates, and those are two easy alternatives. And I would say it's appropriate to do that always. Why is it? Because it's not appropriate, especially as kids get older, they start noticing things, and they start wondering, and they see the heker, and they, you know what I'm saying? And it's very important for parents to have a level of of tzinius in their marital life and protect them from their children. And I think one example that just on a tangent, forget the meals and forget Kiddush, is children do not belong in their parents' bedroom. It's inappropriate. I think that, you know, I hear a lot very often about how, you know, children are sleeping in their parents' beds all the time, and you know, children are in their parents' rooms all the time. And aside from the fact that it's terrible for the kids because they never learn the sense of independence and they don't sleep and the parents don't sleep, which is well documented, children need to respect parents' right of privacy. And I think it's a good rule. I think it's an incredibly good rule that children should learn, A, they must ask permission to enter their parents' room, and B, they have to knock. This is not your room. You're not this is not your place. This is our private area, and it's not appropriate for you to be in there. Because sooner or later, they're going to notice if the beds are together or the beds are apart. And I'm not a proponent. I know in many circles, the parents have the beds apart all the time, so it's not them to notice. But and I would say in our circles, that's not the way we do things, and sometimes it's together and sometimes it's not. But the fact that it is that way, the fact that the beds are sometimes together, at a certain age, a child will notice and begin to wonder. It's not appropriate. It's not their place, and it's not their room. And that sense of privacy should be kept from them to whatever degree is possible.
It's really a practical, easy solution for that, to reconcile both practices. He says some people always keep them apart. Some people two beds, one which is a double, if your bedroom is big enough.
Yeah.
One which is a double or a queen, whatever though.
Right.
And one which is a twin.
So then it's always,
always apart, and yet sometimes you're sleeping in separate beds.
If that's feasible.
If it's feasible. I mean, cost-wise, it makes almost no difference. Cost-wise, if you have room in the bedroom.
Well, those parts of the bedrooms are really small, so I mean, how feasible that is. I mean, if you're living in the spacious Southfield, I don't know how the bedrooms are.
Standard in Chabad?
Did they do that in Chabad standards?
Okay.
I mean, I've seen that there's either a double or a single. Yeah. That could be done. Okay, I mean, that's a good idea also. But I would argue at the same time,
they still should be locked.
You still don't belong in the bedroom. I mean,
I agree.
Parents have things and items of clothing and things of that nature, and perfume, and a mother has makeup, and all of these things that children have no business knowing about, and it's not their business. The parents, they should have a private life, and I think that's an important lesson as well. Yeah, Steve.
As far as the halakhos, is there a difference when in the Shivan Kim or
no?
Like that?
No, that's a good question. Halakhos, a woman is a nida from the moment she sees blood until the moment she goes to the mikvah. Her status as a nida never changes.
Even though we said really all that is truly, I'll call it a chumra, but
it's no. They were machmir on themselves to treat dam like a nidus. We have to assume that it is. Once you assume that the dam is dam nida, a woman is a nida from the time she till the last moment until she goes to the mikvah. Right. It doesn't matter. She's done her bedikah, she's done her whatever, she's still a nida. Let's say she doesn't go to the mikvah, which is a terrible thing and inappropriate, she's still a nida. I don't care how long it is. If a woman is a nida, a woman is a nida, and the halakhos apply to husband and wife under all circumstances, no exceptions. Yeah.
What is the difference between public and private?
What do you mean?
The harchakos in public and in private.
In general, we try to maintain harchakos in public as well as in private, but the factor of tzniut and appropriateness does become a factor. So obviously, that doesn't mean a husband and wife can hold hands in public,
right,
because they don't want people to know. But let's say the child is screaming, or they need to, or the stroller, and the wife can't carry the stroller on her own. So we are lenient in certain situations for certain harchakos, not all, for certain harchakos, like the examples that I gave you, like passing a child or passing an item. If you're sitting next to your wife, and I say, for some reason, oh, do me a favor, pass this to Ronya. So you're not going to say, no, I don't want to pass it to her. I can't right now. That's inappropriate. So that then the value of tzinius and privacy trumps the value of the harchaka temporarily.
Yeah.
But that the danger that is, then people tend to minimize the harchaka, which a person shouldn't do. Okay, one other example of a time when we believe it is, God forbid, if a wife is sick and the husband's taking care of her. So then if incidental contact, or if let's say a woman literally can't get out of bed and needs to be tended to, and there's no one else there, then the halacha is much more lenient for the husband to address her needs. But other than that, it's not appropriate. Another issue that comes up very often, if a woman is a nida, can she sing in front of her husband? So Rabbi Forrest says no. The poskim say no. But many, what I would call the poskim that I've spoken to, not many, some of the poskim that I've spoken to are much more lenient when it comes to kodisha, even zemiros. We don't think that just like a woman doesn't have to cover her hair in front of you, so you can also say that her singing is also not considered a dvar erva, such an erva that it'd be considered so enticing that she couldn't do it when she's a nida. The last thing a hakaka that people aren't aware of is that you have to be sort of careful about the kind of outings you take when a woman is a nida. That doesn't mean you shouldn't go and enjoy a reading at the library together, but certainly it's not recommended or appropriate to take a romantic Vegas getaway. Well, probably not appropriate to take a romantic Vegas getaway anyway, but you gotta go to Miami Beach for the weekend. A woman is a nida. That kind of activity, that kind of intimate activity, even if there's no intimacy, it encourages it. And the Chazal very, very strongly, were very strongly discouraging of that kind of behavior.
Okay. How makbid are we on being on the same bench and in the car?
We are makbid on being on the same bench. Obviously, if it's one bench, if the bench moves. On a couch, if it's one cushion.
And in the car?
In the car we are machmir, but I mean, how many people have anybody, maybe in the back seat it's a problem, but in general the back seat is considered two seats anyway. They're separate from one another. It used to be a problem with the bench seats, but I'm pretty sure that Ford and GM don't make bench seats anymore. You know what I'm saying? All the seats are really separate. It's tricky. The hard part in the car is when the woman's in need and she's passing you stuff, like you're going on a drive to wherever, you know, and she's trying to give you dinner. You know what I'm saying? And she's putting it on the dashboard, and you're, but that's
groceries bags in between.
That's what you have to do. Okay.
When people get lifts.
What?
When you get a lift to somebody else.
Oh, and
husband and wife.
And squished in next to each other. So that becomes a problem, and the post can go, and they're not so lenient about it.
It's something in between.
Well, you have to find a way, right? Even something in between is not appropriate, because that's really physical contact. You could say, I'll sit in the front, you sit in the back, or, there are appropriate ways of doing it, if it's possible. You have to try, and you have to weigh. Again, that's a harchaka. It's not a harchaka. That's, physical contact is something we're going to be more careful about than passing one thing one to another. So you have to try and be careful about it. Okay, very quickly, we're running out of time on the tape. So how long is a nidus? So we said the minimum is, when a woman sees blood, the minimum is 5 days. And the reason is because it's a very involved halachic, how should we say this, categorization. We're afraid that a woman had... Even if a woman bleeds only 2 days, we say it's possible she has to wait 5 full days. Why? Because we're afraid that she had relations on the night, on the evening, thinking it was the day before, and really the day after. And we know that the Gemara says that a woman is poletet shichvat zera for 72 hours. And so that's the fourth day, and then she has to have at least one more day. So the minimum that we say is a minimum of 5 days of dam nida. When a woman becomes a nida, the minimum that we can consider that she's a nida is 5 days, almost no exceptions, except for a kala and under certain circumstances, infertility perhaps. But normally the minimum is 5 days. So from the day she sees her flow, she counts 5 days. If she bleeds more than 5 days, she's a nida as long as she bleeds. 6 days, 7 days. After the 5 days are up, or the 6 days, or however many days it is, then she has to define, she has to establish that she is pure, right? That she's no longer bleeding. And then she can begin to count her 7 clean days. Okay? So how does a woman establish that she is pure, that she's no longer bleeding? So she has to do what's called a hefsek tahara. Hefsek tahara is simply a bedika. What's a bedika? A bedika is an internal physical exam. And this is also when many shilas come up, especially the first 1 or 2 days. A woman will see very often, almost always, I would say, it's rare for a woman to see absolutely no discharge on a bedika cloth, especially the first day or two. And very often, the discharge or the staining on the bedika cloth is not blood. But I get a sense very often that women assume that any stain is a problem and just wait for the next day. And that can become very challenging, especially in cases where women are trying to get pregnant. Right, obviously, the closer you are to ovulation, the more likely it is that you're going to get pregnant. And the more days you delay, the less likely it is that the woman's going to get pregnant. So it's very important for women to understand that is a very important shayla, the bedika cloth, and the color on the bedika cloth, and stain the bedika cloth, should be submitted. It has to be looked at. Because more often than not, it's not a problem. And unfortunately, it's treated as a problem. So a woman does a hefsek tahara, that bedika. It must be done before shkia on the day that she wants to start a shivan akiyam. Must be before shkia. The times are very, very critically important. You might notice on the chart that we send out at the Young Israel. So one of the things you write is Shkia, latest night for Bedika. Very, very important. Now, that chart is a little tricky because every so often I'll get a call saying, I did it at, and the time was, you know, I did it 2 minutes afterwards, and it just so happens that that week the time is getting later. In addition, there is a little bit of window of time. Rav Moshe writes about a little additional window of time, but you don't, shouldn't play with it at all. Very important. It must be done before Shkia, before sunset. And if it's done after Shkia, then the Hesetar comes to the next day. You lose a day, which is annoying. Very frustrating.
What does Rav Moshe say?
Rav Moshe says you have up to 9 minutes after Shkia. That's his blanket, absolute latest window. But we try not to use it unless you have to. After that, again, one of the mach chumras that the women brought upon themselves was called a moch dachuk. Moch dachuk. A moch is a spun, dachuk, dachuk, forced in there, squished. Okay, and the moch dachuk is simply a bedika cloth inserted in the vaginal cavity, and women leave it there until after tseisa kochavim, 45 minutes at least. Okay, and if any blood is, you want to be certain there's no blood in there, that's a good way to find out. You take a white cloth and you find out if there's any blood on it. And moch dachuk also has a lot of shilas, a lot of color discolorizations, and it has to be asked. Very important to be asked.
And the moch dachuk has to be removed before shkia?
No, after. It's inserted before shkia and removed after tzeit, 45 minutes later at least.
So what's the purpose of the moch dachuk?
If you leave something in for 45 minutes, if there's any blood in there, you're going to find it.
But the
bedika
is not...
The women felt the bedika was not enough, and in addition to the hefsek tara, they do a moch dachuk.
After the
bedika.
Oh, okay.
Right, okay. And then a woman can begin counting a shiv and a key. And this is a critically important thing that women sometimes confuse, and it's a terrible thing. I had a case once where a woman was not doing the proper bedikas, and it turns out that she was really not permitted to go to the mikvah for years. It's important. In order to establish shiv and a key, you must do a bedika on the first and last day. Meaning the day after the hefsek tara, you must do the first day. Because if you don't do a bedika that day, how does she know that the first day was clean? In addition, the bedika must be on the last day. The bedikas must be done during the day. The halacha says, ideally, a woman should do bedikas twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening before shkia, after it's light. Okay, so it should be twice a day for 7 days, it's for a total of 14 bedika. And unfortunately, sometimes women find it difficult to do, and they should be encouraged, and this is another role the husband has, to encourage women not to forget to do the bedikas. It's very important. Okay? If a woman doesn't do all her bedikot, b'di'evit, it's okay. But it, again, it has to be stressed that women should do every bedikot they can do.
As long as you did the first one.
At the very minimum, absolute minimum, it must be done the first day and the seventh day. I had a case where a woman called me and she explained that on the seventh day, she was doing her bedikot before, especially in Detroit, before she went to work. It was pitch black outside.
In the morning.
So it turns out she was not doing the bedikah on the seventh day.
She didn't do the seventh day before.
Right, and she was going to the mikvah all the time.
She didn't do the seventh day before.
No, she had never done for years. She had not done a bedikah on the seventh day.
That's a popular...
Because that's how she was taught. Yeah, very popular. So it's very important to be careful and to warn and to be aware that the hefsek tara must be, that the bedikahs must be done every day, but especially minimum first day, third day for sure, and seventh day, and all 7 days, because without which, a woman is not permitted to go to the mikvah. Okay, my tape is running out, so I guess we'll stop here. If you have any additional questions, that's good. Otherwise, I thank you for joining us for this brief but general overview of Hilchos Nida, and hopefully it will help us all be more careful and meticulous about our appearance in this important general topic of Jewish law.